Now it's your turn with the pussy.
Welcome to episode 3 of Savage Babes. We never thought we'd get here. I'm Donald Sutherland.
I'm Dr. Benny Graves.
Also known as Peanut.
I'm Peanut.
We're sponsored by Skullhead Vodka and Ghostbusters The Frozen Empire, brought to you by Dan Aykroyd.
We actually demolished half of John's house and replaced it with a pop-up that's like a bar that looks like, I don't know, the Ghostbusters firehouse, I guess, would be the thing they do, right?
I would totally do that. And I would even make a giant crystal skull.
And, you know what else you could do? You would have one of the dogs, but it would be, for some reason, it would talk. And it would be like when you got your table to eat a bunch of like overpriced appetizers, but like, John, your table 23 is ready.
Why hasn't that already existed? Ivan Reitman and all them should be marketing that shit.
Oh,
now.
No, my ideas have already been stolen. It's been seconds.
I feel like everybody, like I was just telling Benny off air that like I just saw an ad for the McGuffin's Bar, which is AMC's franchise bar that's in some of their dine-in establishments.
Oh, it's actually called the McGuffin's.
Yeah, it's called the McGuffin's Bar. Great. And, you know, Dan Aykroyd's got an ad for his Crystal Skull Vodka cocktail for Frozen Empire he's promoting. But like, seems like every celebrity now has some sort of like themed brewery beverage, something like, you know, Dan Aykroyd's got Crystal Skull. Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman have Aviator Gin.
Well, Ryan Reynolds also has that cell phone company.
Oh, the cell phone
he
company.
He owns the soccer team. Right. And every time you see him now, he's like, I'm just a normal guy with his glassy ass eyes because he's a fucking replicant.
And then I was thinking of this, Aaron Paul and then what's his face from Breaking Bad have their own, was it like Dos Hermanos?
Okay.
Or
okay. Oh,
they
yeah,
have
yeah.
their like saying whatever the fuck it is. They have some sort of
fucking Jason Momoa has like I think it was a vodka that we tried when we were at Beard John's house watching Aquaman 2. And it's terrible. Well, it's not terrible. It just has no. There's nothing interesting about it. I was like, we were all saying like this should have been a tequila. It feels like that's more his brand.
Yeah, I guess there's probably some Hollywood financial advisor that's probably like, you know, you need to, if you want to have the longevity of your money and your growth and your investment, sometime when you retire, you need to have your money in an alcohol brand.
It's tale as old as Entourage when Turtle has that tequila brand.
Oh, I've never watched Entourage.
Terrible. It's a show where
I should clarify that. I've seen bits and pieces of Entourage to know the gist of Entourage.
Yeah, it's a show where nothing bad happens to anybody, and it's like a bro power. It's like putting a game shark into like Dane Cook's life. You know what I mean?
No.
So like every episode is like, oh, Vince, we don't know if you're going to get the role as, I don't know, Frank Sinatra, even though you look nothing like him that Scorsese's doing. Oh, no, you didn't get it. But, oh, turns out you're going to be in this Richard Donner, whatever, Martian Manhunter movie. And also you bought everybody Maseratis. And, oh check God. It out. It's all these Victoria's Secret models. They're making love to us. So, babble, beep, wow.
Yeah, Entourage occupies that same place as, like, Shameless and, like, HBO's history. And, right? It's HBO.
I don't know.
Is it Stars? Or is it Showtime?
Entourage, I believe, is definitely HBO. But I don't know if Shameless was HBO.
Oh.
But I
remember it was
say,
that time, like, in between Sopranos and whatever the next prestige big thing, like, I guess Game of Thrones or something like that. Everybody was like, oh, my God, the Entourage series finale. And I'm like,
oh, no, that's true.
Who are these people?
The problem with, I think that probably Shameless is even a better show. Shameless is a show I started to watch. And then I stopped watching it because I was like, these characters are not evolving. They are literally existing in these boxes, and the writers know that because the show has become successful. They're like, stunt everyone's development.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know.
But we're not talking about any of that.
No, we're going to be talking about Undefeatable.
That's right.
But before we do that, Benny, what do you got going on? Because the last episode we kind of rushed through because Jesse had a gun to our head about making sure these episodes are
make it faster, make it faster, make it faster.
Yeah, make
Daddy.
An appropriate length.
Mommy, don't leave. We'll make the podcast the right length.
We had 22 episodes to get through where it just leads up into an Angie Harmon, David Hasselhoff kiss at the end. So God. We had to power through that. So I apologize because we were like rushing through the episode.
I mean, admittedly, it was a lot of content.
Yeah, you want more peanut content. We had to condense it down to get all the vital nutrients out of it.
Well, so what I'm doing is I've been doing approximately bi-weekly articles for Rue Morgue called The Analog Abattoir, and I'm covering various things that
peanut. And they pay you $100,000 a year for that.
They do. I'm extremely wealthy. Thank you, Analog Abattoir, and thank you, Crystal Skull Vodka.
There's paid advertisements on your blogs, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Just that money doesn't go to you.
But what I'm going to be doing is July 27th, if I'm not mistaken, I'm going to be in Buffalo, New York. You can check out the Buffalo Horror Garage sale for the info. I'm going to be doing an introduction for the movie Mausoleum. Fucking, what a work of art.
Film's a 10.
And then the next day, I'm going to be at the actual garage sale, probably at different levels of drunk. And a lot of people are vending there. Jordan, Subatomic Mini, is going to be vending there.
I mean, she's a Buffalo native.
And she is making, from what I saw, she's making little replica versions of the, I guess it's like the barn, the shack from the end of Zombie.
Oh, where they have the holdout.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And they look fucking great.
It's a shame because that movie and like Zombie Holocaust that were / Dr. Butcher, all those movies kind of like coalesce in my brain and the scenes are kind of interchangeable for me.
I only recently saw Dr. Butcher and I was like, you got Cannibal Holocaust in my zombie. Yeah, in my Cannibal Holocaust.
I've only seen the Zombie Holocaust cut. I haven't seen the Dr.
That's the one kind of you want to see, cut. But I heard that the Dr. Butcher one is full of like stupid shit that they added in, so I kind of have to see that too.
Similar to this movie that we're about to discuss that has actually two different edits.
Oh, I don't know about this.
Yeah, there's... So we're going to be talking about Undefeatable, and we'll be talking about Cynthia Rothrock a little bit later. But to get started, let's get into the movie. Woo! Undefeatable from 1993. So the Undefeatable title is the Western cut for Western audiences, and Bloody Mary Killer is the Eastern mm-hmm. version of that, which is, so this one had a runtime of, I think, of like 95 minutes, something like that. It's an hour and 35
hour
minutes.
and a half.
Perfect. The Chinese version, the Eastern version, has 88 minutes, and they basically truncate it.
Did they cut gore or something like that?
They cut a lot of the actual rape scene itself is taken out. Okay. Just the aftermath rape scene. There's a whole, like, so I have the Vinegar Syndrome release, which has both cuts of the movie, but they also have a double feature. They have a feature in there that's just the just like the editing differences that they did. It was just it's like an 8-minute presentation. I can only get through like 4 minutes of it because it's just the blow-by-blow scenes.
If you hear weird fleshy sounds, it's Gimli chewing on a toy. It's not us at a glory hole, by the way.
Yeah, it's him with the stuffed, I don't know if people are gonna be able to hear that or not, but it's him with a stuffed bone that I have to occupy him because it's a rainy day that we're recording on right now and the dude hasn't been outside.
The boy
and
needs his energy.
So I had to give him a flesh nest to focus on. So Undefeatable actually goes by a lot of different names in different regions, so I copied a few of them down. It goes by The Final Challenge in Brazil, The Invincible in Germany, also Street Queen and Killer in Germany.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Unbeatable in Hungary.
Street Queen and Killer!
It's like a band name.
It's a Judas Priest song.
Search for the Murderer in India. Final Heat in Japan, and finally Rebellious in Russia.
Oh,
I don't know why.
A woman is outside and she thinks she fight like a man. Too rebellious.
The woman don't listen to a cop. She belong in gulag.
She wears men's pants. Too rebellious. Gulag.
This was rated R. I don't know what the budget was, and I don't know what it grossed, but I will tell you after watching Godfrey Ho talk about it. At one point, Godfrey Ho is like this prolific. He worked underneath the Shaw Brothers.
Oh, hell yeah.
He walked. He was a contemporary with John Woo when John Woo was working with the Shaw Brothers. So he was like an assistant director for the Shaw Brothers for a bit. And at one, and then he branched off and started doing his own stuff. At one point in the 80s, he was doing 10 movies a year.
Yeah, he's
which is a rigorous schedule.
Prolific.
But the thing is like with unlike like Italian directors and like certain other studios, these guys had making movies down to a formula, and it was all about profitability for them. It was like, can we market this? Let's talk to our distributors. Is there a market for this in the Western audience? There's definitely a market in the Chinese audience. Let's do the bare minimum we can to print a movie.
I don't think that Italians didn't want to do that, but I think that their problem is that their disconnect from American culture, what they saw versus what they put on camera, is so insanely different.
I would just say that it was very much like, oh yeah, we'll make a Jaws 5 uncopyrighted version. We'll make a Terminator 2. But
it's like if they were making the Masters of the Universe figures and they put it in the press, but it's a bootleg press, and the press comes out and He-Man's like, help me. And they're like, that's good enough. Fine.
His elbow's bent the wrong way, but the children will love it.
He's a little bit wall-eyed, but American children are a little wall-eyed.
It's Insect Man with his bifolding kneecaps. It's
you cannot
all right.
have such profound pectorals and not be a little bit chromosomally challenged.
I don't mean to disparage the Italians, but what I meant to say is the Italians would just like throw anything at the wall to see what would stick, and often they would do like movies like Shocking Dark that have like 8 different genre concepts in one thing, thinking that the U.S. market
will. But come after us, you fucking Strombolis. I dare you.
Yeah, but the Chinese and the Hong Kong studios would very much be like, okay, the distributors want this type of film. We're going to make 10 of these types of film, and we know that we're going to get X amount of return for each film that we do. And if we have to do a bare minimum of editing to make it palatable for either audience, we will do that in a heartbeat. And so Godfrey Ho is very much of that type of directorial style. So let's get into... So this movie turned a budget, but I don't know what budget it did, and it definitely did. It definitely made back its
money
in VHS.
Not enough, based on the quality.
Taglines. Out of the ring, into the fire, in a fight to the finish.
She was not really in a ring. She's doing, like, illegal street fighting.
Right. And by street fighting, we mean, like, 5 people are watching it.
Yeah, but...
And they're fighting in an alleyway.
All of them are, like, Streets of Rage gangs. We have Streets of Rage at home. Gangs.
Yeah. I mean, I wish it was like Streets of Rage where you call the police and a guy comes with an artillery rocket and he shoots it into the street and everybody blows up and there's napalm and then everybody's fine and they just move on.
Oh my God. What the city planners, they're having aneurysms.
Also, where did they get the budget for that rocket launcher? But
when the shadow of a serial killer falls, the terror starts.
Yeah. Okay. That's true. The serial killer with a very specific MO that they can't find.
A very specific but general MO where anybody with a flower dress and a red wig or any type of reddish hair
Also, that DNA should be everywhere.
The cuckoo bananas ball, like, they copied. I mean, there's like, also, you know, Charles Bronson got in on it with 10 to Midnight. There's all sorts
of... That's true, that's true. It's for jacking off.
All right, it's time for Back of the VHS.
Karate champion and martial arts superstar Cynthia Rothrock rips into action against a serial killer, facing her most dangerous opponent ever. Struggling to put young sister Karen through college, martial arts expert Christy Jones Rothrock earns fast cash by competing in illegal back alley matches. But Christy's rough and tumble lifestyle takes a terrifying turn when Karen falls prey to a savage killer. As the police working the case discover a trail of murdered victims, their only clue is the killer's grisly trademark, an unusual martial arts technique known as the Chinese Dragon Claw.
Oh, shit.
Teaming up with a streetwise police detective, John Miller, Christy sets out to avenge her sister's death and must fight for her life against the most lethal adversary imaginable. Fox Home Video, 1993
AKA
release.
High Sodium Paul Reiser.
Yeah, and the thing is like everybody involved in this movie, with the exception of Christy Rothrock, was basically in the same dojo.
Oh, as
one of the producers.
They're not actors, first and foremost?
No, they're not.
What?
Suspend your disbelief. So as I mentioned, director Godfrey Ho, he has 150 directing credits from the mid-70s all the way up into the year 2000s. Chances are if the movie had ninja in the title, Godfrey Ho produced it.
He directed Robo Ninja or Ninja Terminator?
I don't know. I didn't write all these ninja titles down because it was like Ninja Team. Ninja Theory.
I think I have one of his.
Ninja Spatula. Ninja
Champion, I believe.
Ninja Karate Man. Ninja this. Ninja that. And he has like a different pseudonym for like almost every one of his fucking movies. Some sort of amalgamation of Godfrey Ho.
Yeah, he did Ninja Terminator. That's the one I'm thinking of. He did Honor and Glory, which I haven't seen.
Honor and Glory is where he previously worked with Cynthia Rothrock, and that's how he kind of knew that she would be good for this film.
What I can tell you that I do know about this, and I not even from anything I read, but from sheer knowledge of his art, is that actor Richard Harrison is in like 50 of his movies, and he's the one who would splice together. Like, his movies would splice together American actors with existing martial arts footage to attempt to create a chronological plot. So it'll be like Richard Harrison in a hot pink ninja outfit being like, I have to find the secret sword. And then clearly a man who is 2 feet shorter than him, but in the same ninja outfit fighting like vampires.
Yeah, Cynthia Rothrock talks about that in her like interview that's on the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray. And she's basically like, if it was anybody else, I'd probably say something to him, but like Godfrey is known for reusing footage and reusing her footage as well for other fucking pictures and stuff. And she's like, it's like an endearment thing. Like, oh, we just come to accept it that, this is how Godfrey is. He's just a scamp when it comes to reusing footage.
Oh man. Apparently he also did a movie called Laboratory of the Devil, which is about, Unit 731 in Manchuria, which was a Japanese death camp.
Oh no.
And I read about this place. It's actually interesting that this is what he did, and it's I'm not gonna get into it, but it is a bummer, let me tell you. It's pretty much like the equivalent of like Mangala shit to the nth degree.
So if you want to watch and follow along with us right now, this movie is streaming for free on Amazon Prime and Tubi.
Get on there.
And I don't know if it's sold out now, but so Vinegar Syndrome in 2023 put out the 4K Blu-ray. There's a 4K version you can watch. There's a Blu-ray attached to it that you can watch. And then on top of that, there's the Bloody Mary Killer version on there that you can watch, and there's a bunch of special features on that. They actually interviewed the guy that played Paul. They interviewed the actress that played the psychiatrist. They interviewed Godfrey Ho, and it's like, oh, they're like, maybe most of them are like 15, 20 minutes long.
John currently has it on a plush pillow, and every time I reach for it, he slaps my hand out of the way.
Yeah, I love the artwork is actually...
They just released, Vinegar Syndrome just released China O'Brien 1 and 2. Also Rothrock.
That's actually on pre-order. Yeah, that's on pre-order right now. But they're going, I would say that they have a pretty extensive Cynthia Rothrock catalog, and they probably have the rights probably for all her films. But we're actually going to talk about that right now with our Savage Babe of the episode, Cynthia Rothrock.
Machi, machi.
Cynthia Rothrock as Christy Jones. So a little bit about Cynthia Rothrock. She was born in 1957 in our very own backyard, Wilmington, Delaware. Where all the shell companies get incorporated at.
Yay!
And also where Melilla lives.
They could have been best friends.
But she spent her childhood in Scranton, PA, home of Dunder Mifflin. So she's got that office credit. So she started actually doing martial arts like when she was like 13. Wait.
Wouldn't it have been fucking great if one of the gangs they had to fight was Prison Mike? Michael Scott comes out, he's like, I'm gonna see you in the clink.
They should have found a way to add the all the Anchorman gangs into Paul Rudd and all the street fighting.
Next at 11, the streets will run red with Burgundy's blood.
Telemundo 5 coming at you.
That would be fucking great.
So she holds she's a 5-time world champion in forms and weapons from 1981 to 1985. She currently holds 8 black belts in multiple martial arts disciplines. She's an 8th degree black belt in Tang Soo Do, in Taekwondo, in Karate, the Eagle Claw, Wushu, Northern Shaolin, and
I'll have that one with egg roll.
Pai Lum Tao Kung Fu.
Oh, and that one, no beef in that.
In 1983, she was inducted into the Black Belt Magazine's Hall of Fame as Female Competitor of the Year. In 2014, she was honored with the Legacy Award at the Urban Action Showcase and Expo at HBO. In 2016, she was inducted into the International Sports Hall of Fame by Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dr. Robert Goldman.
Wow, my friend, Cynthia Flintstone is one of the greatest people I ever know. She brought me Bronto burgers and I ate them.
She's the only one. When I told her to put on the maid outfit, she refused.
Then she kicked me in the wiener.
In 2022, she received the Martial Arts Super Show Lifetime Achievement Award in Las Vegas. Past recipients have included Chuck Norris, Fumio Demura, Benny the Jet Urquidez, and former Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell, amongst others.
This is impressive shit. I was reading this as well, and yeah. I was like, this is legitimate, like, breaking glass ceilings, like, intense stuff for a woman to do.
In March of 2024, right now, currently, Black Belt Magazine named Rothrock number one on the most influential women in martial arts on the planet.
Oh, shit.
So,
counterpoint, Chun-Li.
Fictional character, Chun-Li?
Counterpoint, Melina.
Well, you know, she was based on, you know, Sonya Blade from Mortal Kombat was based on Cynthia Rothrock. So she has that kind of pedigree.
I gotta tell you, I have such a crush on Cynthia Rothrock. I've always had a crush on her. And when she, like, kicks those dudes' hands and makes them touch the floor, it moves.
No, man, she's still good looking now.
She looks fantastic.
She's actually in her featurette that she did for this movie. She talks about is there something you want to promote? Something's going on, and she is directing. It's supposed to come out late 2023, so I have to imagine it's out now. She's doing a Western called Black Creek.
Oh, shit.
It's supposed to be a really dark one. And she's like, I always wanted to do a film like this. And I'm like thinking to myself, like, you've been in martial arts your entire life, but like the dream movie that you always wanted to work on was a Western.
I don't know. I that's like a really storied life. Like we joke around a lot, but like what she's accomplished, a lot of people, you know, can't even. I'm sure that there are dudes out there. There's like a fat dude in an Enter the Dragon show. He's like, I bet you can't kick that high. And like to constantly have probably so many men saying that shit and to be so accomplished, that's fucking wild.
Well, I mean, it's for a woman to break into that, you know, they would use and not to be wrong, I mean, like, we'll talk about it in the movie, but there's always people, like, there's several times in the throughout this film where like a person just has martial arts skills and it's not even explained.
It all seems like it makes sense,
and that's because all these people were actually in that scene at the time, and there was only a few handful of women doing martial arts to that skill level at the time.
Right? Like, the joke when you watch kung fu movies and stuff is, like, everyone knows kung fu. In this movie, everyone knows kung fu. No one does it. Maybe the only people who don't know kung fu are the coroner guy who's like, this is gonna look terrible when you see your dead sister.
Even the bookie knows kung fu, and even the bookie has a history.
Oh, man, the kung fu, the bookie. We'll talk about him.
So, in 1983, she was discovered by Golden Harvest, a.k.a. Orange Sky Golden Harvest, a prolific Chinese film production, distribution, and exhibition company based out of Hong Kong that ran from 1970 to 2009 while in Los Angeles, California.
If you've seen, like, any sort of kung fu action movie, if you are familiar with any of them, you've come across a Golden Harvest production.
So, her first film would be Yes, Madam, a.k.a. Police Assassins, or In the Line of Duty 2. There's four of those films. There's a box set, I think 88 films put out. That's all region that you could.
Is that the one with Michelle Yeoh?
Yeah, so that's her first co-star would be none other than Michelle Yeoh. Current Oscar winner, Michelle Yeoh.
Well deserved.
She would remain in Hong Kong until 1988. She would film seven movies there. Rothrock would go on to be one of the few Western movie stars to find success in Hong Kong first before achieving stardom in the U.S. The 1990 film Martial Law, starring David Carradine, would be Rothrock's first U.S. produced film, and she would go on to do a lot of American action movies for the next 10 years in the 90s. So her filmography includes, as I mentioned, Yes, Madam, 24 Hours to Midnight, Magic Crystal, Righting Wrongs, Fight to Win, No Retreat, No Surrender 2.
I have that.
Top Squad. As we mentioned, China O'Brien 1 and 2, Martial Law 1 and 2, Triple Cross, Lady Dragon 1 and 2, Prince of the Sun, Rage and Honor 1 and 2, The Tiger Claws Trilogy, Fast Getaway 1 and 2, Angel the Kickboxer,
Fast Getaway 1 and 2. Not to be confused with Fast and the Furious.
No, that's definitely not that. And she did, so when, you know, the whole drawn out story with New York Ninja that Vinegar Syndrome recovered. Mm-hmm. They recovered the assets. There was no audio track, right? Yeah. So she was one of the voices that they dubbed.
That's an all-star dubbing, isn't like Linnea Quigley's in there.
Linnea Quigley's in there. Michael Berryman's in it.
That movie's worth watching just because of the accomplishment of its existence.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like Vinegar Syndrome found archival 35 millimeter footage, discovered that this was a lost print for a movie that never actually got distribution. It was pretty much finished at the 11th hour, but for whatever reason the audio track was missing from the completed stuff, so they did a lot of lip syncing to the dialogue of what they thought was going on. And they had actually had to edit the film, right? They had
pieces of it that they had to put back together,
and it wasn't in order, right? So they had to suss out what the actual plot was going to be, and then they got their Rolodex out and figured, okay, well, we have all these contacts for all these people that did featurettes for our Blu-ray and 4K releases, so who could we contact to do the audio dubbing for this? Right. And so you got Rothrock
Miamadeus.
Yes. And all these other horror actors like Michael Berryman and stuff doing it. And now it's seen the light of day.
That's right.
But the guy who did that, I guess, is a recluse who lives in Vietnam now, and they actually had to track him down.
I read that as well. Yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy accomplishment.
There's a mini documentary that's in that.
And you've
release.
Watched it.
Yeah, and it's actually pretty interesting. Because we talk about restoration, it's done to go on a soapbox, but like we talk about like Blu-rays and like how they're actually participating in like the restoration of some of these films and media. It's not often. I don't know of any other examples of where they were able to resurrect the movie from the grave.
Is a big accomplishment. Like, not everything that Vinegar Syndrome releases hits for me, and some of it is, I feel like, I'll be honest, some of it is like outside of what I feel is the range of what I think they should be releasing. I like, for example, I don't care about Navy SEALs, but I really care about Haunted Ween.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting when they do mainstream releases like that. Like they've done, what's that Chuck Norris movie they just did? I'm blanking on it. But, They did that Chuck Norris, Jonathan Brandis sidekicks.
High kicks.
Yeah. So they do some like, and they did like
Roadhouse.
They just did Roadhouse. Yeah. They did what's the movie with the chick from Saved by the Bell?
They did
Striptease.
No, it's Showgirls.
Showgirls. That's it. Yeah.
The Paul Verhoeven movie.
Yeah,
that's insane.
Yeah, they do every now and then. They get weird rights to stuff, and it's a mainstream release. Navy SEALs is a fine movie to me.
It's about what you can get too. That's the thing. It's about what you can get the rights to. You know, but I am interested in the weird niche shit like New York Ninja. And I guess the other thing I want to ask you is like, what is your how into kung fu movies are you? I guess we would call this a martial arts movie.
I kind of made my way into it through the exploitation stuff, like going
like
to the
X-Fest.
Like going to X-Fest and seeing Fistful of Talons and Dynasty 3D and
Dynasty. That was the one with the guy with the metal suit, right?
Yeah.
And they showed it in 3D and he like puts on a full metal suit and just like flies around in the woods.
I got into it through that and like watching Force 5 and what's the weird zombie movie?
Raw Force.
Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. Like that was kind of my vehicle in. I don't know if I really like straight, like Hong Kong produced Shaw Brothers stuff. That's not really my interest. I can respect it from a distance, but for me, it's not.
I think the baseline of that is stuff like Master of the Flying Guillotine and like the Venoms movies, which I haven't seen, and Five Element Ninjas, which I think they played that at X Fest as well. I love that stuff. I just mentally am incapable of starting to collect that because I can't do it.
Yeah, it's not something I would collect. Like I actually like this intersection more of like when you start intersecting like Americanized plot lines and 90s action martial arts.
This movie intersects the sweet cream.
Because I have all their other, like I have all the, I forget the name of the black guy that did all the Taibo shit.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Blanks. Mm-hmm. Billy Blanks. Like, they have all that, along with Cynthia Rothrock's library, they have a lot of Billy Blanks movies. And a lot of those are also kind of
Love the insane, campiness. Like, urban decay, and everyone also knows
TC 2000, like, post-apocalyptic, like, any type they can shoehorn another subgenre into a martial arts movie has always been, like, enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, straight Shaw Brothers stuff, like, I mean,
the Van Damme stuff, I think, is great. That was that's very similar in that vein. There's, like, a corniness to that stuff
that really sticks with me. Like, mainstream audience, right? I know. This is stuff that was, like, straight to video that were, these were populating the video stores, you know.
Kickboxer from Hell. Somebody send me the VHS.
Is there Muscle Bodybuilder? Is that related to Muscle Bodybuilder from Hell?
It's a D-grade, I believe, sequel to Kickboxer that has a satanic element.
All right, so you ready to get into this movie?
Oh, am I?
Are we doing the shots now? Should we do the shots now?
I'm trying to see. Where do we... we should do the shots now.
So that they kick in by the final scene that we talk about?
Yeah. What is it? Rattlesnake Rosie? This is like...
this is pumpkin pie, whatever it is.
Yeah, pumpkin pie whiskey. Are we ready, mommy?
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, brother.
It's got a little back end to it.
Undefeatable, sick chrome font. Looks like the same coloration as the Mega Man 2 font.
It's like the Bigfoot font, right?
Yeah.
Bigfoot.
Get your monster trucks here. It's like, now we're going to go right into the movie with a woman talking to her therapist. Women be talking
and
about the men folk.
Women be laying on the couch like they're a centerfold. Women be sprawled out in horny position.
So we find out that there's this woman, Anna, and she's dating this guy Paul, who used to be a mechanic, but he kind of
he was like, I've been working on Chevys all my life, you know what, I think I'm gonna start taking HGH and murdering men in the ring.
And we get interstitial of Paul and another guy fighting in a ring, which they use like three scenes from that, right?
Yeah, they do.
And the actor that played Paul said that shot of them in the ring with this guy took an entire day's worth to shoot.
I think that they're going for like a lot of very cinematic in a tableau type scenes.
But the rest of the movie is not really this tone, right? The slow-mo back shot lit.
I'd say there are a few
spotlight.
I'd say there are a few shots where he's really trying to make it look like a moment captured in time of like beautiful violence, you know? The other thing I want to talk about is how, unfortunately, Paul killed King Hippo, you know, when they were in the ring together. It was a very tragic accident.
No, we just made him spit out his mouthpiece in slow motion with
Paul
blood.
Wouldn't do that. He'd take out a fucking, he'd take out a flea market knife and gut Mike Tyson.
This is what sucks. I wish they kind of would have doubled down on, like, Paul's... quote unquote, because Anna makes a point of mention. I think they call them death matches, and I'm like, was this a time period where like death match was a new word that we just discovered?
It might have. I mean, this is pre-internet, internet is ancient or not ancient. It's very young at this point, so I guess maybe some people don't know that.
So I was just like, okay, whatever, fine. We're saying death matches has this gravitas.
One would say my husband has a perm. One would say my husband looks Paul Reiser.
Right away, you're introduced to steroid Paul Reiser's eyes and his craziness. And would you believe he was cast largely in part to his eyes? And
how they were really deep set into his head, like walnuts that were jammed into like a fucking orange.
And then the pinprick accuracy in which he can glance about the room. And
you know how some people, their problem is they don't act with their face? This man's problem is he only acts with his face.
I mean, he is all face and hair.
The expressions in this movie are like someone took the close-up scenes from Ren and Stimpy and was like, do that, more intensity, more, never stop, more intensity.
More bulbous veins, oil, please.
Oil, more oil.
Vaseline, please, oil. So actually, he was actually going to cut his hair for the role too, and Godfrey was like, no, you leave that beautiful mane alone.
I want you to look like an utterly insane Rufio later on.
And he's like, what? That movie hasn't even come out yet.
Oh, there's a Rufio later in the there's a budget Rufio later on in this movie.
Oh, I know.
We cut to after this whole slow motion boxing scene. Boxing and kicking, though. There's boxing and kicking going. He's got boxing gloves on. He's kicking. I don't understand.
We're doing like mixed martial arts.
Some Streets of Rage street toughs come into a pizza place and they're going to rob it. But, nope, there's a police officer there who...
looks like Flyboy from Dawn of the Dead. If he did HGH...
He is. He, 110% right. He looks like Flyboy.
Yeah.
R.I.P. And he takes the two guys down and pulls out a giant revolver.
I love the idea. So he tries to stop these guys. He knows martial arts. And the guy, the one tough, lifts a machete and goes, "Suck my dick," and tries to chop him. And I was like, that's like a really interesting choice of words before you fucking stab someone.
This movie includes such memorable lines as "suck my dick" and "see you later."
That's right.
So the next scene is Cynthia Rothrock and her wannabe greaser gang, the Red Dragons.
Yeah, I called them a gang that loves dressing up like George Michael.
And they stop at an alleyway with three Sopranos rejects, I guess you could say. Three guys wearing sunglasses and presumably being Italian mob guys. And
they are stilted Italian Americans.
She has her first fight with what I call the Bone Thugs and Harmony reject.
Oh, that's interesting that you picked that. I had Belle Biv DeVoe.
I said his name is 2 Chainz Skull Bandana.
The best is how bad the Italian guys are acting. Like, everyone is very amateurish. But they especially, because they're always putting them in like a platform. They're always having them stand on the top of stairs or something along those lines so that they have some sort of authority. And they're always like, "Okay, you know the routine. Here we go." It's literally like the mobsters from The Simpsons attempting to act.
"Yo, what are we doing here, Paulie Walnuts? What about you, Johnny Tight Lips? I ain't saying nothing." I just feel like the movie description and everything leads you to believe, like, oh my God, she, you know, Cynthia Rothrock is in these really bad back alley brawls. They're so illegal, but it is the most tame shit. It's like, it's not a death match. It's not a fight to the death. It's not a fight to incapacitate. It could be, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's touch your hands to the ground and you'll lose.
Yeah, it's also, here, I get Streets of Rage is the wrong comparison. I wrote, we have Final Fight at home.
Final Fight's not even, like, at least you got, like, Mike Hagar fucking roundhouse and people and bear hugging and drop suplexing and stuff.
All right.
Don't tarnish my Super Nintendo beat-em-ups and my Sega Genesis.
This movie is great.
We'll talk about it. So they have a fight for, like, a 3-second fight. She gets the guy to capitulate.
El Diablo, right?
Just as she's getting handed her wad of cash, Mr. Cop comes by and picks up her money and nabs her up, and she's the only one that they catch out of this whole fight.
She, like, runs after the money, which is important for later information.
So, cut to, Karen is on campus, and she gets informed by the other Red Dragons who are trying to do this Three Stooges routine.
They're doing, like, a yuckster bit. They're supposed to be, like, wise asses.
It's like, oh, how come I don't see you guys on campus? Are you guys gonna, like, finally sign up for classes? No, they said our IQ's too high.
They bring that one back. they're like, insert joke here. And Godfrey's like, do the IQ thing again!
Do what we talked about. So immediately we get the interrogation scene. That's a trope to me of, like, you're such a pretty girl, why are you doing this, pretty woman? There's no way you should be doing hanging out with these street toughs.
That's right.
You have so much going for you, like cheekbones and eyebrows. And
there's a lot of conversations like that where pretty much Cynthia Rothrock front loads here. She's like, yeah, I'm not from a wealthy family at all. I'm doing these street fights to make money so that my sister can become a doctor so that we can live comfortably. And he's like, yeah, don't do that. Hey, look, just to put your boot, you know, you just got to pull up your bootstraps.
Yeah. Well, immediately he's like, where do you get this wad of cash from? And she's like, from the Blue Moon Diner where I work at. And he's like, there's no diner waitress making this much money.
Even at that time, that's a poverty wage.
You make 5 cents an hour plus tips.
Oh, God. I remember when I was working as a waiter, my fucking boss would love being like, well, it's not my fault that the check's literally $0. That's the government's fault. And I was like, come here for a minute. Come here.
It's not my fault you're sleeping in an alley with a mattress and maybe there's mold on the underside of it.
Hey, Ben, where you going? Just around the corner. I work there.
He lets her go, but he pockets her money, and Karen finds out about, you know, Cynthia's Christie's fights, and she treats her like contusions on her back, and they have like this heartfelt humanizing discussion about what's going on, and, you know, she just wants Karen to stay in school. And because that's how you be cool, is by staying in school.
That's right. Drugs are whack, yo.
And meanwhile, Paul's wife is cooking him his favorite steak dinner in a frying pan on the stove. And
which is a steak only externally cooked. Inside, raw. Outside, completely burnt beyond belief.
One side is cooked, one side is raw. She never gets a chance to flip that steak. Because
he's trying to put it inside.
Because immediately, as Jessup would say, there's a dick through denim.
Yeah, he literally shows up and she's like, oh, are you hungry? He's like, Paul, horny, not hungry. And he's trying to fucking raw dog her.
And she's like, no, please, no. Oh, I gotta flip the steak. I can't. The one side's raw. You're gonna get salmonella.
And then I think this is when the mommy talk comes into play, right?
Yeah, he gets some. It gets
weird.
Really weird.
It gets really weird. Paul, the guy who looks also, like Paul, gets weird.
He's also having flashbacks to his fight, and he's getting like hard off of like the death match that we saw previously at the beginning of the film.
I understand what Godfrey Ho is attempting to do here. I also understand that what he saw in the recipe is not how it turned out. Like, you remember that meme that came out where it was the person making the cake that was, it was like the frog cake, and it was like what it was supposed to look like, and then what it actually looks like, and like the eyes are slothing off, and someone put it in the audio from Hunchback of Notre Dame. He's like, I am deformed.
Right.
That's what this movie feels like. There's an idea of what we wanted to accomplish, and then there's the execution of what we got. And I love the execution.
I mean, it does a lot with saying very little, which is, I guess you could say, kudos to Godfrey for being able to pull that off. And then he commits like the worst meat crime imaginable, and he sits down at the table and eats a half cooked steak where the top side is raw
after rape.
After rape, and his woman is just sitting there shell shocked.
It's so uncooked. Please stop.
So, we get a cut to Paul and his bookie, Lou, and Paul's getting $20,000 for his previous fight that he just had. And in 1990s money, I was like, that's kind of an insane, absurd amount of money.
Early on, I think we established, because he's like, oh, we got a fight in Philly coming up. So I'm like, okay, we're on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Because initially I was like, this bookie guy looks like the type of dude who's like, hey, wait a minute. I got to pull out my midday snack, aka Stromboli, which I packed into my Yankees cap that I'm eating.
Why are you stereotyping the Pierogi brothers like that? That's just
I told the Italians I'm coming after them.
Yeah, he sets up a fight in Philly, and if he shows up to that fight, the award's going to be $100,000. So Paul's like, set it up. Paul comes home with the obligatory apology rape irises.
You know how it is.
You know. Because, you know, what a woman wants more than anything else after a non-consensual sexual encounter is flowers.
There's not a lot of emotional real estate, though, so we quickly get to the dialogue of, if you're hiding, I'll break your fucking neck.
And then he goes and finds Anna's note telling him that she cooked, at least she had the courtesy of cooking him his favorite dinner again.
Half-cooked steak.
Half-cooked steak. And in the letter, she has a line of, every time you call me mommy, you choke the life out of me.
And I'm like, well, I can do both. I also,
Mike, it's not a bad kink if it's consensual.
I've seen this movie before, but I forgot some details of it. And when he opens the letter, I'm like, oh, please, audio narration, yeah. Audio narration. And then she's like, this is why I'm leaving you. And I was like, hell yeah.
Dear Paul, the anal fistulas that you have exploded in my anus. I am seeking medical attention outside of the country.
Paul, you know those schematics of pipes when you pour Drano into them and they just obliterate any innards? That's what you've done to my womb.
You've found the exhaust port in my Death Star trench.
I'm afraid that my vagina will be quite operational before your friends arrive.
Fully operational vagina?
Do it.
So he wastes the perfectly good salad and steak dinner that his wife had lovingly prepared and throws it up against the wall. And he finds his mommy's locket.
His mother's pendant.
Yeah, that plays a lullaby. And then we get the interstitial Paul's abusive childhood, which is basically just basically casual abandonment because his mom was horny and the boyfriend didn't want to spend time with the kid.
Probably Paul, let's say he's in his 30s, so it should be like 1965, but it does look a lot like the 90s.
he was a toddler 5 minutes ago.
There's like, because it's a really, really stretching the budget moment where it's literally the mother and the father seem like they're like Peanuts characters and they're like womp 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 abandoning
it's,
you.
It's stretching the budget because they had probably had that child actor for 3 minutes and they had to shoot the scene in one take and that was all they could.
Yeah, they were doing a Twilight Zone the movie. They're like, we found a kid on the street quickly.
And they exhausted casting the entire Eastern Seaboard to find a kid with the eyes and hair that looked like Paul Reiser's.
Yo, I would love it if the kid was ripped. He's got like, he's like a fucking giant pectorals. He's like, okay, mommy.
Listen, Loretta, I don't want to be around your son anymore because he has those fucking crazy eyes and the fucking mullet. What kid at 13 years old has a mullet like this?
What kind of kid's got a face like powdered toast, man? Let me ask you.
So immediately, we cut to a parking garage where a woman who suspiciously looks like Anna, is about to get into a car and Paul comes up and picks a fight with the woman's boyfriend. I just call these women pseudo Anna because they never really.
Oh, wait, we missed a very important scene.
Go ahead.
This is when he does his Rufio dye job. For right before this. Oh, right.
He does the spray, the red highlights in his hair.
Which is completely gone in later scenes.
It's there in some scenes and it's not. Yeah. It's like very inconsistent.
I mean, it was probably like leave-in dye thing that like comes out almost instantaneously.
There was probably not a continuity director for this film, which.
That's strange.
So yeah, he gets into a fight in a parking garage with a dude that we later find out is a karate champion. And, most notably, he pokes the guy's eyes out and kicks him off
of
a parking garage roof into a parked car.
And did I rewind this moment? Of course I did.
It's a good choreography. That guy did, that dude does for Booga off the parking garage. So, then Mr. Cop pays, Christy a visit at the Blue Moon Diner. And they have a little bit of banter.
The Full Moon Junction Diner.
The Two Moon Junction Diner. And he leaves her money back in tips. And then Red Dragons come in and tell her that they've got another fight proposal for her. And meanwhile, Paul is taking Anna and hoisting her up in some sort of warehouse with chains.
It should be pointed out, this woman, yes, she kind of looks like Anna, but throughout the movie,
no, they get worse.
Okay, it's like bootleg of Anna, bootleg of bootleg of Anna. Yeah,
it's the video treasures Anna.
Exactly. And you're like, excuse me,
made for TV movie Anna,
like the selling an Ozzy Osbourne shirt at the in the parking garage, but his face is horribly distorted.
3D printed Anna at home.
Paul doesn't really have good vision, I assume.
Novelty popcorn bucket of Anna.
So yeah, they're, you know, initially I was like, these kind of look like Anna, and then
inexplicable terror, H.P. Lovecraft version of Anna.
It's the alien resurrection room Anna.
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver's clones version of Anna. Number 7. Where was I? They find the dead boyfriend's body in the parking garage with his eyes plucked out, and that's when they have the line of dialogue like, "Oh, this guy was a karate champion. He got his ass beat."
Oh, and I like to point out, we do get one scene of him like chain whipping this woman,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he's got a warehouse that he rents. Question mark? Is it the garage that he uses as a mechanic?
Personal dojo or of something? Course. Something he had with the bookie. And then they find the woman's body that's folded into a porta potty, and they casually mention that she's been raped and her eyes have been torn out.
No big deal.
Cynthia goes to her Christy goes to her next fight with the bear, which I called ginger bandana with some football pads on, because that's his shtick.
Yeah, a paunchy guy in Zubaz named Bear. That's what I have going on. I guess he's a sports themed one.
Yeah, sports trailer park redneck. football guy. He's definitely
Chris
like,
Pratt with gigantism.
Even the beat 'em up games wouldn't touch him as like a fodder enemy that you would get. He's not even cool enough to.
Do you remember you actually have him? You know what he reminded me of, and I don't know why. It's the you have him up in your shelf of your many knickknacks. It's the construction guy Ghostbusters figure.
Yeah. Generic.
Where his chest would fall backwards, but in his generic form.
He's like three tiers down below the village people. This is the guy we got. So she has a fight with Ginger Bandana guy. I don't understand the banter that goes on. There's like some heckling, but the heckling isn't really good.
It's incoherent.
Poor little baby bear. And to steal his mama's Tupperware, I don't understand this dialogue like whatsoever.
Someone explain what Colonial Quispy this is, because I do not understand it.
So he's defeated. As they're like leaving the fight
bear.
Ring, Paul drives by and he sees the girlfriend of Gingerbeard. Kind of looks like Anna because she's wearing a flower dress and she maybe has red highlights in her hair.
He's squinting. He's astigmatism.
So. Bear and his girlfriend go back to their trailer park.
Were you kind of shocked that we were seeing this? This is like, again, I'm pillaging from Rick and Morty. It was that interdimensional cable episode where they're like the real fake doors guy. And he's like, real fake doors. Then he walks out of the door and gets in his car. And you're like, what? We're just following him now? And he goes back to his house. And I was like, why are we following this guy? And then, yeah, you know, it's because his girlfriend looks tangentially like a woman.
Because we have to establish the serial killer.
She look like a man.
But I like when they get back to the trailer and she's like, I gotta go to the can.
Yeah. And he's like, get me a beer.
I'm all plugged up from watching you fight and lose.
Smokes right now.
So immediately Paul gets out and he's like, Anna, you're coming with me. And Gingerbeard gets his ass whooped for the second time today. His
neck snapped.
And he gets Dez. And then we get the interstitial. We have to establish that the cop also knows sweaty karate.
Indeed he does. And he's very sweaty.
Uses a bow staff. And
it's just like a lot of these feel like training demos. You know what I mean? It feels like a VHS you would get. And it's like, these are the best techniques to use when using a bow staff.
It also feels like that Godfrey was very much like, we needed to have a police procedural, but also a martial arts movie. And I'm going to zipper these up together as best I can.
And no, stop. He's already dead.
Yeah, so there's this just B-roll of cops. Because this next scene is also very much police procedural. Like,
oh, yeah.
The mayor wants this serial killer business solved. This guy who's just dumping women in flower dresses in porta potties.
And it seems like Nick and his partner, they're like pretty chill about solving this case. They're pretty relaxed about it.
They're also the only two detectives in the entire Washington, D.C. area. Because I always love these movies where like, yes, there's a police department, but there's literally only one detective. He handles all cases, and that's it.
We used to be a country.
We used to be a country. We used to be something. Yeah, when does Donald Trump make his cameo in this to be like, I approve?
I love Stingray. Giving a bad rap, frankly. Why would you hang a towel on a nail in the corner of a refinery?
Stingray has been with me on Epstein's Island. We were drinking buddies. Beyond that, I really don't really know the man.
Love, you know what? Trump would say something like, love the man's hair. Looks like the curls on top of a Viennetta. Beautiful, refined hair.
But if you're telling me that he killed somebody, then I don't really know the man. And,
I can't speak for him. I can't speak to what he does with the knife he got in the flea market.
He is one of the few people who can speak in dualities of like, he's my best friend, but also we couldn't be more distant at the same time. And we met in a closet
you
once.
You could say Donald Trump's a master of neutrality.
So after the police chief tells Mr. Cop that, you know, they have to make this serial killer a number one priority, we finally get the scene where Paul runs into Karen, and she is now pseudo Anna number three. And there's an inexplicable fight scene between Karen and him. And Karen presumably knows karate.
Everyone knows karate.
Because she fights back. And the guy that she's with is a red dragon, I think. And he fights back, but he gets his ass thrown against a pillar. Then we get a nice B-roll shot of filler of Cynthia practicing with her hook swords.
One of Cynthia Rothrock's personal favorite weapons.
Yeah. Understandably, because she'd be rocking them, and I'd be lying if I wasn't like...
Sibbity sopping.
You keep rolling on that ground. Mr. Cop arrives with some bad news, and he doesn't really sugarcoat it all. He's like,
no,
Carrie, your foster sister is dead.
That's pretty much how he says it. He's like, Karen, I have something to tell you. Your sister is dead. Okay.
Her eyes are plucked out, and we want you to identify the body with the eyes plucked out. So she goes and identifies the body of Karen, and we do get a shot of her eyes.
We brought the coroners with the least bedside manner for you. There's that one guy, and he's like staring directly at the camera. He's like, I want to warn you, this isn't going to be easy.
Have you seen the movie Devil's Reign? Do you know the end scene with William Shatner with his eyes out, that, you know, that became the Halloween Mike Myers mask? We put that on your sister's face.
The only thing that could be more insensitive is both of them were doing the coroner bit where they're eating sandwiches and they're just like Italian dressing and like fucking oil and is dropped falling on the corpse.
The trope of the medical examiner or the coroner always eating a hoagie. I love that trope, but
I dropped some Capicola inside your sister's mouth. I'm sorry.
I got my junior mints up inside your sister's cavity.
Yeah, I love this scene especially, too, because when in the behind-the-scenes feature, when Cynthia was talking about Goffrey as a director, he would do this thing where if there was one person talking towards the camera in a scene, he would put up his hand and make a puppet motion next to the camera to say, talk to the camera. And she said when she was doing this heartfelt scene of, like, mourning over her sister's body, he was right on the other side of the corpse making puppet hands to be like, talk to the camera, Cynthia.
It's definitely, like, an Oscar scene. They're going for the Oscar with her being like, oh, dear God, this papier-mâché head is my sister.
And look, I love Cynthia. Not everybody can be all things, but her emotional gravitas in terms of mourning her sister, not the best. Maybe you get what you work with. I don't know.
Look, you can either be really good at hook swords or you can mourn your dead fake sister.
So immediately, I thought I was watching a different film all of a sudden because we cut to the Red Ninja Art House performance.
That's right.
I'm like, why is this happening? Who is this person? Why does he have a groupie following?
Great Value Vega, right?
He wishes he was Great Value Vega.
Well, that's why he's Great Value.
Where's the mask?
Put it on. Please, God, put it on.
Where are the claws?
Please, God, you look like a character who would be in Heavyweights. Please, God, put it on.
So, Cynthia or Christy is suddenly there to pay the Red Ninja a visit, and she thinks that he had killed her sister because she had observed the wounds on her sister's body and kind of figured out. They don't really do a good job until much, much later of showcasing that, like, we think there's a martial artist.
That's an exposition dump.
Yeah. So anyway, all of this is a pretext to say that there's going to be a battle on some oil drums, and we're going to have a little kung fu battle.
It's pretty cool.
And then, of course, just when the fight's getting good and you're wondering what's going to happen, they have to have Mr. Cop show up and take Red Ninja into custody.
Yeah, I also want to point out the beginning of the scene. She shows up and she's like, the guy's name is Lee, right? And she goes, you killed and raped my sister. That's my suspicion. And he's like, whoa. I may have raped that other girl, but she was asking for it. And I was like, whoa, what is this guy? Right, admitting sexual violence? And everyone's like, that's fine.
He's like, I may have done some non-consenting, no means yes type stuff, but what I didn't do was pluck your sister's eyes out and fucking put juju beads in her
chest cavity. That was a different woman that I raped.
I definitely didn't put William Shatner's fucking prosthetic eyes from Devil's Reign onto her body.
I definitely didn't take two raisinettes and put them into the empty sockets of your sister's eyes.
I definitely didn't take a fondue stick and put it up your sister's hoo-ha.
That's right.
Gimli is here and he's mouthing off. Give me 1 second.
Yeah, and now John is chasing him like a Looney Tunes character around the studio to try and get him out. And he knows what's up because he wants to hang out with us. Because he's just sweet baby. No, he's submitted. Oh, he's thinking about it. Oh, now he's just playing with John now. The hunter has become the hunted. I feel like I'm doing a Looney Tunes narration.
It's been raining all day, and Gimli has been pent up in the house, and he's being a pain in the ass. But this is what you get when you join these extra episodes.
Well, Nick Yeah, Nick the karate cop is like, oh, I want you to know I'm not a regular cop. I'm a karate cop. And yeah, the wounds don't match what Lee is known for.
It reminds me of that karate rap song. Remember that fucking 80s karate rap?
No, yeah. Oh my God. But also, they have like negative chemistry together. Like, they don't have no chemistry.
Well,
they're like two polarly.
They have negative chemistry. And again, Nick keeps doing this like mentorship program with Cynthia.
Where he's supposed to be like a dad.
And it's like, there's no reason.
And this is a mommy movie, not a daddy movie.
Yeah, I don't understand the relationship dynamic. But anyway, Cynthia's, Christy's like convinced that like somebody's using this technique on the bodies. I know who it was. It was this Red Ninja dude. And then as Nick has to mansplain, basically, that I know this shit too. And this is not, you're wrong. You're just wrong. You have to believe me, you're wrong. And then the partner always has to come in and be like, we did the lab thing and the lab thing said that, yeah, Nick's right.
Oh, man. His partner, who kind of looks like him to the point where I didn't look up the credits. I don't think they're related, but they kind of have the same doofy Men's Warehouse actor haircuts and shit. Right.
So one of the Red Ninjas tells Cynthia about this other dude.
Oh, dude.
Ryko, who I do call Rufio budget version. And he was in a fight with Ryko, and he used a similar technique on him, and he kind of shows his little baby scars on his neck. And he's like, if I had been looking the right way, I'd have got it too.
Well, this seems great too. There's some great dialogue delivery because he's part of a band called The Maniacs. And he was like, oh, The Maniacs, they're a bunch of doofuses. And he was like, now they're a bunch of crackheads and they do anything they want. And I was like, what? Like, they do crack?
The Maniacs, whose claim to fame is they're using out-of-season Macy's wear.
I thought that they looked early 1990s death metal band.
It's just not intimidating whatsoever. But anyway, so Christy goes and looks up, rolls up looking for Ryko and his crew. And beforehand, she calls Nick to let him know what's going on.
She's a narc.
And I don't understand why she would even cooperate with him. There's really no reason for that to happen. And so eventually it turns out into an all out gang fight.
The best is she shows up and I think she's asking questions that immediately tell that she is an informant.
Right.
And so the fat guys, who look bigger in this scene, and I would have loved an effect where it was like Scary Movie 2 where the deputy's hat gets bigger, where the guys are bigger.
The sunglasses keep getting bigger. Bigger
until literally they're like cartoonishly giant suits.
Yeah, they're like, we don't want no parts of this stuff. This is not where you're here to fight. You ain't here to ask questions. and stop asking about my pocket hoagies, all right? You're not getting any, so stop.
Calzone fell out of my back pocket.
It still turns into a gang brawl, but when it's getting good again, Nick has to show up and basically arrest everybody.
Nick has to show up, hold his arm up in the most stiff-armed way, and fire a gun in the air. The most wooden delivery of this, like, stop a conversation or fight, I'm speaking now moment.
Cut to Karen's funeral, and by funeral I mean they're going to stand at her headstone because we ain't got the budget to dig a hole, much less.
Godfrey, what's our budget?
Not hole digging budget.
I can tell you that.
What's our funeral budget? You get tombstone from behind with no engraving.
It keeps falling over.
You know, we can chisel a piece of foam that looks like stone, right? No prop budget either. Fist budget.
We only have budget for one styrofoam tombstone, but only one of those plastic prongs on the bottom. So fall over a lot.
Spent entire budget on Paul Reier's moose. You know what it takes to contacts to keep Paul Reiser's eyes like this? The man doesn't blink in any scene.
That's because they kept, you know, half the budget was them scooping the salt off of pretzels and just feeding him it so that his eyes would sink into his head further.
Oh, shit. So then we cut to the cops and they're trying to, they want to bring in a subject matter expert, aka a kung fu master, to try and figure out what technique this guy is actually using. And this is our cameo by one of the producers who actually is running the dojo where all these kind of actors/martial artists were discovered. And he is basically talking about that there's really only three Americans who use this type of dragon technique. So then we get an interstitial of Nick and Christy going to a house where a guy isn't home.
Thank goodness, by the way, that all of them live in Pennsylvania.
Everybody lives in Washington, D.C., where this was filmed.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
His partner goes to another guy who turns out to be handicapped. And then we go to a boxing gym where we get this group fight scene with Nick.
I love the handicapped bunch of sweaty guy, by the way. They open the door and it's Nick's partner. And he's like, yeah, I'm Joey Pantaleone. And he's like, wah, wah, wah. He can't even use his legs.
He's like, are you here with my fleshlight? You know, been on account I can't really get my downstairs working.
Did you bring my Westworld giant metal dildo that I can strap myself into? Please, please tell me about that. Yeah, it's kind of some scenes that are meant to burn some film.
And we have to establish that the three people that they're looking for aren't actually the suspects. And we already know that as the audience. So, yeah, there's a whole giant fight scene in this gym. And Christy's there and she finds the gym owner who tries to run and she captures him and they fight. And guess what? It turns out that this third suspect isn't the person they're looking for either. So I forgot to mention at Karen's funeral, aka the tombstone rap party, Dr. Simmons shows up again. Is kind of questioning.
She gets to join their Scooby gang
because she was Karen's teacher on top of being a therapist, and she just wanted to be.
She knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody.
Right.
There are like 12 people in this town.
Right. And so Nick brings Dr. Simmons to the police department to hopefully try to shed some light on the serial killer and do some very, very light mental profiling.
Light mental she's like, here are some extremely inaccurate generalities.
No, she's basically doing the he looking like a man. So what you're saying is
here's his extremely specific MO, and yeah. Nick's like, I am a police officer.
This is exciting. I'm glad I went to DeVry University and got my online degree. After that whole Trump University thing didn't pan out, and I stuck with it for DeVry University.
There was like a Photoshop cartoon of like a cop with a thumbs up in the corner of the degree. This means I'm a detective.
But she kind of thinks that she sits down at the table and there's gruesome murder photos, including Karen's fucking dead.
She's fine with it.
And she's like, oh yeah, these things. Oh, I think I might recognize one of my patients.
Wait a minute. But let me check. Woman? See, I'm very good at finding patterns. I also happen to take martial arts classes 7 days a week.
So she goes back to her office and she pulls Anne's file. And right around that time, Paul returns home in a murderous stupor and collects his mail that's been piling up in the mailbox.
Uh-oh.
And there he discovers the address for Anna's therapist, Dr. Simmons. And
you think that there would be like some sort of confidentiality thing that would keep that from happening?
Was there HIPAA back then? There probably wasn't HIPAA back then, was there?
Yeah, I hope so.
No, because the men would have to know everything that the woman
was
doing.
That's true.
Back then.
We used to be a country.
As the head of the household and the woman as his property. So at the same time, Dr. Simmons calls Nick and she's like, yeah, this sounds like this dude who used to be a mechanic who now does death matches. Anna's
a small world, you know.
So they immediately go to Paul's house, but he's not there.
No warrant. They just break on in there.
And they're like, whoa, ew. Remember fucking carpeted stairs? Yeah. Loose carpeted stairs?
They're like, those flowers look like the flowers by the killer. Here's a picture of a lady that kind of looks like the lady who did. That's enough evidence. Let's find them.
So at the same time, Paul pays a visit to Dr. Simmons' office, and she's not in, but her secretary is, and we get some ominous
torture time.
Yeah. So Nick, for whatever reason, violates all amount of police procedure to tell the victim's sister, Christy, precisely what they found, and they go together to Paul's bookie.
His daughter, mommy, yes.
And so they go there, but the bookie leaves because he's concerned about Paul, and he wants to go to the warehouse to figure out what's going on.
This scene is like
And the old secretary is there.
She has a whole role. She has a whole internal life we find out about.
Yeah, and she's like, horny for Nick, and...
No fucking problem.
I'll you hear the squelching sounds of her thighs.
I'll tell you the second he gets back.
Isn't he a cutie? And Cynthia Rothrock's like, he looks like a piece of shit.
And she's like, would you like some partially warmed Werther's Originals that I've been sitting on this entire time? They've been warmed by my ass.
And Nick's like, no, I don't want that at all, actually. We're going to leave. So, cut to Lou. He goes to Paul's warehouse.
Mickey Ravioli? Mickey Ravioli walks into this warehouse, and he's like, hey, old Paul, what are you doing? Oh, this is interesting.
This is a nice fish tank full of what appears to be human eyeballs.
Why does he have eyeballs in his... Oh, what do we have over here? Legs sticking out of a small industrial-sized toolbox? What's in... Oh, a dead body?
And then Paul shows up and he's like, you've seen too much. And turns out my eye collection is missing a pair.
Again, there are every... I sent you the text. I'm like, every line reading in this, like every other line reading in this is perfect. He goes, what? Are you crazy? She's dead. I mean, I didn't mean that. Like, but it's all said in the same tone. Yeah. So I'm like, good. Good, you fooled him.
So
he starts choking him, and the Italian guy's like, "God,
it would be totally a shame, Lou, if I had to choke you now."
Now listen, I'm one of those guys who orders in Olive Garden, but I'm gonna try and throw a punch at a guy who has like ripped people in half before.
Time is a flat circle here because Lou's body is already immediately dumped by some dumpsters, right? And the cops find him, and they're like, damn, we were so close. And
instantaneously, yeah.
At some point, Dr. Simmons returns to her office, and there she finds her secretary slumped over. And there's a fight. There's a small fight scene between Paul and Dr. Simmons. Well, you know, Dr. Simmons knows Kung Fu.
There was a scene, I think, right before that where like he's torturing another lady. And for a second, I thought it was Dr. Simmons' secretary.
But it's not. He adopted another. Because sure. I thought the same thing, too. But they don't look.
There are so many Annas, you know,
it's hard to keep track. But I'm glad that we both. So he abducts Dr. Simmons.
She tries to fight him. Because she also knows martial arts.
And she gets taken back to the warehouse. And then we get this very funny attempt. She tries to do all this psychological warfare against him. Where she's like, first she's Anna. She loses her hair. And she's Anna. And then she becomes his mom.
Mommy.
And
she was like, I watched in my psychology 101 class, I watched Friday the 13th part 2
and
so
Psycho.
I can pretend to be a mommy.
And it somehow works enough for him to chain her up and
go get groceries for her.
Please go get me a junior. Please go get me the finest baguette.
Yeah, I kept imagining she comes back or he comes back and he's like, I got the groceries you wanted. She said, I said flank steak. And it's him like, sorry, mommy. And he keeps leaving and coming back. I said ribeye. She's just buying time by having him go to the A&P repeatedly.
But anyway, probably the most suspend your disbelief moment. She is able to manipulate her cell phone to call Christy
with
to
her
let
foot.
Her know.
With her shoe wearing foot.
With a 90s cell phone.
Yeah.
Come on.
I believe it would survive her foot squishing. I don't believe you'd be able to hear anything on it.
Or accurately dial anything or hit a button. Christy shows up, and then we get this comical warehouse fight scene between the three of them.
We get the Looney Tunes switcheroo, where suddenly Dr. Jennifer is facing the other direction. She looks nothing like Dr. Jennifer, right. But as we established, Stingray and the astigmatism.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
Also, Christy has red hair, too, to be fair. But what's funny is, like, she frees Dr. Simmons, and they're having this three-way fight, but every time Dr. Simmons gets involved, she gets pushed in.
Leave! Just go!
And then somehow during this fight scene, the cops show up, they've got guns, and then suddenly Paul's got a gun, and he in the struggle and escape, he shoots Nick's partner in the neck.
I see what Godfrey Ho is going for here, because it's like a tiered fight. So first they do regular martial arts.
Right.
Then he has a samurai sword. She has hook swords. And this is the scene where he's like, I wrote packing penis to Godfrey Ho what doves are to John Woo. And so like, as they throw up all the packing penis and they're like snowing, that's another tableau scene where they're right. Like, the actors are literally standing still because Godfrey Ho is like, it's like snow. And I'm like, yes, it is like snow. Very good.
Years later, they would do Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon aboard bamboo shoots. And I want to feel like this scene was all leading to that.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, we go from swords to guns.
Guns, and Paul, in a shootout, Paul escapes, and he's able to kill... I like how Nick's like, please, breathe out your neck hole.
Breathe, you bastard. That's your last words to your friend.
Cut to Nick and Christy. They pay Dr. Simmons a visit in the hospital. She's all banged the fuck up. And they put a guard on the door, and they go to leave, and the cops like, my God.
You're missing some amazing stuff here, including that Rothrock, like, fractured her arm, so she has it in a sling, and she's holding the fucking cooler with the soup they brought her. Nick, take the fucking cooler!
Also, what is this, like, you're in the hospital because you got your ass beat? Here's some chicken soup.
I love the idea of Nick being like, you got the vote, you hold the fucking soup.
You take the 60-pound Stanley thermos. So anyway.
It doesn't seal fully, so be careful, because if it rustles around, you'll burn your arms real bad.
Also, it'll test positive for lead, but don't worry. That's the lead vacuum on the inside there. Holding
keeps
the
things
in.
Warm.
So there's immediately an introduction to a plainclothes police officer who's sitting in the door, and he's like, immediately like... Wait, you want me to watch this bitch for 24 hours? But what about my lunchtime?
Yeah, it's literally it's a living moment. Yeah.
And they go to leave, and obviously Paul's already there, and he's already got a doctor's outfit on, because Paul is a master of all things.
Where'd he get it
including
from?
Including impersonation.
How'd he get in? He's a very identifiable person. Yeah, right. If you drew one police sketch that was accurate, everyone would be like, that guy looks very unique.
You didn't even have to stop. You could have just did the eyes. You could have stopped the caricature at the eyes and just passed it around
like a walnut size dead eyes.
He had the eyes of William Shatner before he got him plucked out in the Devil's Rain.
Man, I love the Devil's Rain.
How many Devil Rain references can we get in here? So they go down the steps, and Paul presumably goes and kills the police officer guarding the door. Conveniently, Paul forgets his sunglasses on her bed and goes to go back up. Or no, Nick forgets his sunglasses, and they have a reason to go back up.
The best part, too, is that when Paul shows up to kill, he's wearing a surgical mask, and he's like, hey, Doc, I'm like, look at that guy's hair. That's the killer. He doesn't need to cover his mouth for you, not to identify him.
You also saw him 20 minutes ago. In movie time, it was 3 seconds ago.
And that cop, so he ganks the guy who's supposed to be watching the door, and we see him, like, shaking, and Nick's quivering. Like, he's dead, and then he runs off. I'm like, oh, wow, this guy has no allegiance.
They're in a hospital. Somebody will come along, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. That hospital staff, they're pretty nonchalant about everything happening.
Yeah, where did they should have had, like, a paging Dr. Crazy Eyes. Ward 7, Dr. Crazy Eyes. Your number 2 appointment's here. Oh, that's me. I'm Dr. Crazy Eyes. He breaks character. So there's a chase sequence, and they corner Paul in the storage area of the hospital, a.k.a. the linen room. And now we get the moment you've all been waiting for.
Oh, yeah, baby.
The moment that has been immortalized on the internet.
Famously, in 2006, which is when I first saw this scene, because this is when the internet was fun and dumb and not populated with real microcosms of horrible hate speech.
Right.
And we could watch a fun video out of context and be like, what is this movie of a man in a doctor's coat holding a knife you would get at a flea market that would be sold by a guy who is definitely a Nazi?
Yeah. The knife that basically is the knife that Slash has from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And you're like, how did they get that little tiny piece of plastic life size and made of metal? So there's a huge fight sequence. They're going back and forth. Cynthia is able to grab Dr. Simons and, or Christy is able to grab Dr. Simons and escape while Nick and Paul fight it out. And at some point, as you must do in every Kung Fu movie, the men must bare their chests and assert their dominance as a sign of mutual respect. And so the bodies be glistening. There's a whole
more intense, more intense, yeah. More intense, more intense.
Yeah, they're leveling up.
More oil, more oil.
It's all
oil.
It's the second stage of Altered Beast, where like the shirt gets ripped open,
yeah.
And they're about to become animals, but they're not quite there yet. And so there's a whole fight sequence with their guys in their bare chest, and he's cutting them up with the knife, and Paul licks the knife and does this crazy thing.
Lick the knife thing. Chef's kiss.
He's like, blah, 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 blah. Nick's like, all right.
Nick's like,
it's like, what's my direction here? Am I supposed to fuck this guy? Or what are we doing here? So eventually, Paul gets the upper hand and he's trying to use the dragon technique on Nick's throat. And that's when Christy comes back in and she grabs a towel and she's basically whipping around Paul's arm and she yanks him back.
That's a really like firm yet malleable towel.
And they fight, and in kind of a poetic justice to the way Paul has been ravaging his victims, Paul gets thrown up against the wall, and he gets one of his eyes impaled on like a nail.
Excuse me, you might be asking why that towel was hanging on another nail in this industrial building. I'm the janitor, and I use those to come into when I am getting lonely.
It would turn out that the hospital that let Dr. Crazy Eyes in is maybe not OSHA certified.
It literally is one of those scenes that you would see in a tutorial video for like how to not be hurt in the workplace. You might gouge your eye on an exposed nail.
Be aware of levitating linen racks and the conveyor system within.
Please watch out for nails that could be holding washcloths.
So they have another fight, and Paul's blinded in one eye, and they're kind of still going at it. And there's a really cool sequence of Nick and Christy fighting him from both sides, and
tandem kind of fight,
and having a tandem fight with him. And they're still doing this really great choreography. And then Paul again is thrown towards a linen rack system where it hangs up the linens and airs them out to dry over the ceiling, right? And Paul gets his eye pushed in again, his other eye pushed in on the linen rack.
How convenient.
And then we get the great catchphrase, "We'll keep an eye out for you, Stingray."
Yeah, see ya.
And then he gets ferbooged up into the ceiling and presumably coated around. And then when you think that was just the end, no, we have to have an epilogue because we need to know.
We need some conclusion.
That Christy has decided to hang up her chains and her gloves for good on the definitely not Karen's tombstone.
This is a fist budget, not a grave budget.
Again, we want you to talk towards the camera and make sure that, this is actually your sister's grave. And that's the end, Christy hangs up her gloves for good, and that's it.
Man, I there are so many things that I could have us judge, like making a jokey rating system for it.
But really, it comes down to how many floating eyeballs in a fish tank do you give this out of 10?
I think I give it a 10.
Oh, really?
I think it's ape shit. I, low-hanging fruit to do on this show would have been something like Samurai Cop, right?
Samurai Cop, yeah.
But Samurai Cop doesn't have the choreography that this movie has.
This has kung fu authenticity. I think where I detract this movie is that it doesn't have the hard edge of an exploitation film in it. It is very much a direct-to-video store VHS 90s action movie.
There's something so innocent about how ridiculous it is. It's something a 13-year-old would come up with.
Oh, for sure.
It feels like a kid seeing an arcade cabinet from a distance and extrapolating what they think that's about, but also they just watched Friday the 13th or Halloween, and they're like, how do I have the two things that make me hardest?
It just,
put them together.
For me, I guess it just doesn't double down enough on like the illegal street fighting aspect of it, and it doesn't double down enough on like the prolific rapey serial killer kung fu master.
Sure.
Like, it needed to like
from an objective standpoint,
be graphic in both ends.
From
and
a creative objective standpoint, there's a lot, obviously, but a lot of problems.
It's a coherent movie.
Yes.
It's edited very, very well.
Yes.
It's shot very well.
It is jaw-droppingly entertaining.
And the choreography that's there, you know, all the choreography is really spent on that last scene.
Yeah.
And the warehouse scene where we have that fight leading up to the guns.
And but most of the choreography is good. The stuff, and you'll be entertained by that. And when you're not entertained by that, you're going to be entertained by what bad actors everyone is.
I wish I had seen more of Cynthia Rothrock's library to say that, like, is this the best one of everything she's done, because she has done so much.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious to see if any of them are kind of cuckoo bananas like this one is. But I would give it like a I'd say it's like a 7 for me, only because I wish, you know, like, obviously everybody's coming over the last scene, but I just wish there was more of that stuff to, like, bring you through the rest of the movie. But it's really, there's a lot of dead area in this movie where it's just like,
yeah, I think it's like, it's Godfrey Ho being very ambitious and being
I
always imagine what the thing that interested me watching this was thinking about how he thought a scene would look cinematically and how it turns out on the budget. And I think there's something really, like, innocent and wonderful about that.
And the whole Nick subplot of him, like, doing this investigation, I feel like really takes away from, like, when the fight scenes get good, but then you have to have him interdict, and it's like, just let this shit play out, man.
He keeps showing up to tell you that winning's half the battle,
right?
And to tell me not to do drugs, and I'm like, I want to do drugs.
And I know that they probably made this for a Western audience where they wanted to make it marketable and not make it such a hard edge exploitation movie where it would have that niche audience. Instead, they tried to make it so it could appeal to a bigger audience.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'm curious. I actually want to cover more Cynthia Rothrock movies eventually, and hopefully we can get there. But,
well, I figured what we'll do is we won't tell each other what the next pick is so that we can be excited or horrified for the next option.
You're only saying that because you probably don't have a next pick.
I do have a next pick in mind. So, from the year 1987, directed by David A. Pryor, Deadly Prey.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm really excited to talk about this. This is a sort of legendary, kind of low-budget Rambo knockoff insanity.
I'm familiar with Deadly Prey, but I haven't seen it. Yeah.
Oh, you're going to love / hate it.
Is there a savage babe in there that we're going to talk about?
There are some babes.
Okay.
I don't know how savage they are.
All right.
I mean, they're definitely savage. There's a lot of steroids also going around.
All right. I'm here for a Rambo-adjacent film.
Hell yeah. All right.
See ya. what's our outro? Should we?
That's it. That's what he says. He says that.
Be keeping an eye out for you, Stingray.
See ya.
Because of the end of civilization, the Clamp Cable Network now leaves the air. We hope you have enjoyed our programming, but more importantly, we hope you have enjoyed life.